Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Car crashes are the leading cause of death for tweens and teens these days, and there's nothing new about that. A new study outlines some of the most dangerous circumstances, riding unbuckled with new teen drivers on high-speed roads. And again, there's nothing really new about that. Jack Torrey knows that. He's the author of Henderson's Light, Drinking, Driving, and a Deadly Encounter. You could have just as easily written the story today. The story occurred, though, 45 years ago. And Jack is with us today to talk about what inspired him to do it and what he learned from it. Jack, welcome.
Great to be here with you, Ann.
What inspired you to write this story? Why don't you give us the setting? It occurred in Michigan. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't tell everybody. Jack Torrey is the Washington Bureau reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Sorry about that, Jack.
That's okay.
Tell us about where this crash occurred and what inspired you to recall it.
Well, the crash took place in where I grew up in Birmingham, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit. And I was in the 7th grade at the time, and these kids were all in the 11th grade. And it was a major accident, and I didn't know the people involved. But throughout the years, whenever I would see a story about a bunch of kids getting killed or hurt in a crash involving alcohol, this crash sort of popped back in my brain. And finally, late in 2004, I decided, you know what, it's about time to figure out what happened to these people. And so I started going back, digging out the information, and making contacts with people who had, there were two survivors, and I wanted to talk to them, but I also wanted to talk to the families. And I was sort of flummoxed because not only did people talk about it, they seemed eager to talk about it, and it was like they were describing a crash that took place yesterday.
It took place 45 years ago. What did you think the relevance would be for today?
I wanted to show how too often we in the news business, we write about these crashes and then they're forgotten. Mm-hmm. But to the relatives, the survivors, it's something they live with for the rest of their lives. No one has ever, to the best of my knowledge, tried to do this, to show how you never escape this type of a crash, that it's part of your life. It inflicts real damage on people. I mean, one of the young men, the survivors, contemplated suicide later. He would have horrendous nightmares, waking up in the middle of the night screaming. He wasn't able to go on to medical school, which is what he wanted to do. One of the sisters had a series of, difficult times because she was trying to adjust to adjust to a life without her brother. And she quite frankly, started drinking a little bit too much.
Very self-destructive.
It was self-destructive. It was very, very, very difficult for these people. And this is a type of thing, Ann, as you know, it happens every year. Since this crash, 500,000 people have died in crashes involving alcohol in the United States. That's more than all the U.S. servicemen and women who were killed in World War II. And yet it's sort of like it gets attention, but nobody's gone back to look at how much the psychological impact of this was.
You first were affected by it personally. Mm-hmm. As a child, you were walking by the gas station where they had hauled the carcass of the Buick that the kids were driving. Were in that night.
Yeah, Birmingham was a small suburb of Detroit, and there were they took them up to the lots of a couple of gas stations, and there was the Ford Galaxy, which was driven by the 22-year-old man who had been drinking, and then there was the Buick Skylark, where the three teenagers had been killed and two survived. And you're looking at these two cars, and you can't. I could see them today. I mean, it was something I never, ever, ever forgot. And I finally decided, for heaven's sakes, this had this much of an impact on me, and I didn't even know the people. It must have had a tremendous impact on the survivors.
At the time, it was huge news because one of the kids in the kid that was driving the car, the Buick that was struck by the Ford Galaxy, he was probably an Olympic bound or Olympic caliber swimmer.
His name was Rod Henderson, which is where the title of the book comes from, Henderson's Light. Rod was a superstar swimmer at age 16. He was already the fastest 100-yard freestyler in the state of Michigan, which is always a state that produces a lot of great swimmers. He was considered a guy who eventually would have been an NCAA champion and an Olympic star had he worked at it. And Rod's personality, which is described in the first chapter, is one that you're not quite sure that he would have done that. He was sort of a happy-go-lucky, fun-loving guy who didn't take life very seriously, at least outwardly. But had he worked at it, he would have clearly been someone on the Olympic team. I mean, he would have broken Don Scholander's national record in the 100 freestyle by his senior year.
You went through the book and described, well, each devoted almost an entire chapter to each of the kids who died.
Mm-hmm.
How did you decide to do it that way? The crash didn't happen at the outset. It happened later.
You know, when I first talked to the former swimming coach up at Birmingham Seaholm High School, you know, it struck me that the fact what I didn't remember was the crash had taken place the night that the Seaholm swimming team had its 49 regular swim meet record broken. They had won 49 straight meets. So it dawned upon me, wait a second, the way to sort of go about this book is to find out what everybody was doing that day, and then to make the reader start to like these personalities, including the driver who had been drinking. The five kids, of course, were out having pizza and Coca-Cola. They didn't drink a drop of liquor that night. So I wanted to. Each chapter takes you one step further toward this accident, and I wanted people to know who these kids were, the ones who died and the ones who lived. Because I wanted the reader to understand these are, in many ways, Ann, these are ordinary kids. You know, Rod Henderson could have been an Olympic star, but the rest of them were like typical high school kids. They were, you know, they worked hard. They were pretty smart. They all wanted to go to college. But there's nothing, you know, you could find a number of people like a Mike Adair, who's one of the people in this, or a mm-hmm. Bruce Barrage. You've seen a lot of them in school. So each step of the way, I wanted to get to build up to the crash, which takes place in Chapter 6.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. If you want to comment, meet Jack Torrey on the phone, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going back 45 years to a horrific crash in Birmingham, Michigan. Four people died, and two were horribly injured for many, many years affected by it. But Jack takes it a step further and gets into the psychology of such a crash and what happens in the wake of such disaster. Jack, you do a pretty good job, I think, of talking about how typical the kids are. You're sort of brutally honest. But on the other hand, it is 65, 1965. It's not 75.
Mm-hmm.
So these kids are relatively innocent. Maybe they, you know, maybe teenagers back then are drinking and smoking cigarettes, but the big drug thing hasn't hit yet. But they are complicated people, too.
Well, they are. I know that you could find at Seaholm by 1968, you could find marijuana, you could find acid. But in 1965, it was a little bit more innocent.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, a lot of kids at Seaholm would have smoked cigarettes. A lot of kids at Seaholm would have drank beer. A lot of them would have been in neck out parties with mm-hmm. their boyfriends and girlfriends.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, you know, we like to think each generation is tremendously different from the previous generation, but most kids are always trying to figure out ways to sort of outrage their parents and their parents' generation. Well, the things that they were doing at that age, which may seem pretty tame now, were pretty outrageous to their parents. And this is all taking place at the time of the British invasion with the Beatles and the dramatic change in American music. The Beach Boys and the Byrds are replacing the Everly Brothers and Elvis Presley. And so I think readers will understand what these kids were going through. And the way they were living their lives. And for baby boomers like myself, they'll be a very easy match.
You use music a lot to set the time and set the tone, particularly the kid who, well, I call him a kid. He was, I think, 22 years old at the time.
Yeah, Mike Drottler, who
was driving the Galaxy 500.
Right. He was driving the Galaxy. He was more of a throwback to the 1950s. As a matter of fact, if you're not old enough to remember the show 77 Sunset Strip.
Oh, you're so sweet, but yes, I am. Go on.
He was Kooky Burns. That's exactly who he was. He was the one always, you know, combing his hair and making it look perfect and driving a nice, fast, hot rod car, and he was as good-looking as all could be. But he drank while he drove. And the irony of this, of course, is that he had had an accident at almost that exact same spot 3.5 years earlier.
A bad accident.
A terrible accident. He was with a young guy named Jay Hengelman. The two of them were driving while he'd been drinking. The car flipped over and smashed into a light pole, and the two boys survived. Jay Hengelman, I tracked him down in Tucson, Arizona, and he described that crash and what he remembered of it. And he is now a juvenile officer in Tucson, and whenever he talks to kids who have been picked up drinking, he says, I want to tell you how lucky you are, because I'm going to tell you about a guy who destroyed his family by drinking and driving.
Was Mike Drossler, had he been drinking the first time he flipped the car? And as far as drinking goes, I don't get the impression that he was rip-roaring drunk.
We don't know for sure. The legal papers all admit he was driving while under the influence of intoxicating beverages.
Because there were beers in the car.
Yeah, there were two cases of Pabst Blue Ribbon. This is a guy who liked having a couple beers while he was drinking. I mean, while he was driving. But he's driving, you know, to drive at 75 miles an hour, it would be sort of like driving 75 miles an hour up Kenny Road near Henderson and you know, running red lights. Well, you're going to hit something sooner or later. So he had a problem. And when I talked to his brother said, you know, he did drink while he drove, and he did it one too many times.
But you liked him. I mean, he was a likable fellow.
He was an extremely likable fellow. He's not the class. If this story were just about one bad guy who made this terrible mistake, and he hit five kids, and this is something that never happened again, the story would have no meaning. The point of this is that, I mean, as the book opens, you're at Rod Henderson's 40th high school reunion. And, you know, his sister, Nancy, attends the reunion, and she's immediately engulfed. I mean, I'm standing there watching this. She's engulfed by all of Roddy's friends, and they're all talking about Rod and Barbara Barnum and Sandy Crispin, the other people who were killed in that crash. And it was obvious that this was something that nobody had ever really moved beyond.
Right.
It was still an open wound. I had people break down and just weep in front of me, and it was as if they were talking about something that happened last week.
When we return from this break, I want to talk to Jack about what the community response was at the time and how the families did cope or not. What they did back then to cope was much different than what we might do today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Jennifer Ludden. 20 years ago, when the Berlin Wall came down, NPR's Mike Schuster asked one woman about visiting her grandmother on the other side.
How do you feel?
I can't say it. Can't speak about it.
Join Neil Conan for Eyewitness to History, The Day the Wall Fell, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon at 2 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning and thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. Currently 54 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20. Sunshine today and a high of 70 degrees. Clouds tonight and a low of 45.
Support for WOSU comes from Thrifty Airport Valet Parking, a valet service for business and leisure travelers that takes you in your car to curbside check-in at Port Columbus, 614-237-5800 or thriftycolumbus.com.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining me today, Columbus Dispatch Washington Bureau reporter Jack Torrey. He's here to talk about his latest book, Henderson's Light, Drinking, Driving, and a Deadly Encounter. The encounter occurred 45 years ago. Jack went back in time to Birmingham, Michigan to meet the folks that were left in the wake of a horrible tragedy. Four kids dead and two horribly wounded by this. But those are just the outside wounds. The internal ones, the psychological ones are much greater. And Jack, maybe this is a function of just the generation we're in now, but gosh, when those kids went back, when the kids went back to school on Monday after this horrible accident with these really popular kids, and not popular in a, well, I guess Roddy was a big man on campus, but they're well-liked kids. And the teacher said to their classmates, you know what, we just got to get back to work now and let's just move on. And that's what they would have wanted. Nowadays, you know, the whole school would shut down and they'd have counselors in there all day long.
Well, school officials have learned a lot since then. And yes, you're correct. They would shut down the school. They would have counselors. There'd be grief counseling. I am not a psychologist by any stretch of the imagination, but I can tell you the way they did it in Michigan in 1965 was the wrong way to go about it. It was, the school was absolutely a hushed shock. I mean, people described it like the day that President Kennedy had been shot. I mean, it was just nobody knew what to say. People bottled up their emotions. Most teachers just went on with school that day. The only thing they did was they canceled a school election for that day, and they canceled a speech that had been scheduled before the students about the dangers of teenage driving.
Mm-hmm.
But no, there was no individual counseling, and of course, the other thing too is nobody was getting counseling among the family.
Right.
And
nothing.
I mean, it was one of the girls who was killed was a young girl named Barbara Barnum. She was, you know, like Roddy. It was sort of like she was dating Roddy. It was kind of like Ken and Barbie type of thing.
Her nickname was Peachy.
Extremely popular. Her father, who was a Navy Cross winner in the Second World War, just shut down completely after that, and you couldn't talk about it in the house. Because if you talked about it, he would burst into tears. And so the youngest girl, Chris Barnum, who was 10 at the time, I follow her through her teen years and then adulthood to show how the fact that she couldn't deal with this, wasn't allowed to deal with it, wasn't allowed to talk about it, really had an impact on her life. I mean, she essentially, her father essentially sort of, locked up is too strong of a word, but he just put a protective umbrella over her. He just wouldn't let her go out with anybody. And years later, after her father died, she finally said, you know, I got to go see somebody. And she finally went into therapy, and it made a big difference. Nancy Henderson, whose brother, who was the younger sister of Rod Henderson, for years it was like, okay, the accident's over. Let's get back to our idyllic life. And it was an idyllic life for many of these kids.
Mm-hmm.
This is a community not unlike Dublin or Upper Arlington in the sense that these are not kids who are known to want things. Whatever they want, they can get. And Nancy is off, you know, snow skiing the following week and flirting with boys and thinking everything's fine. And then years later, she's like, you know, meandering around, not sure. What's causing all this angst, and deciding that, you know, if she really enjoys her life, something bad will happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is something Nancy became a very good poet. She earned a degree from the College Antioch in Yellow Springs, and if you look at her poetry from 40 years later, she's writing about the accident. Her brother, a smile in her childhood, will die by the time he reaches age 16 is one thing she writes. Another time she writes, I gazed the child I used to be. I mean, she felt like her life ended at age 13 the day that crash took place.
The families really, I mean, it was more than just money. They did seem to be very solid. They all socialized with people in the neighborhood, and it was interesting how you set that scene just minutes before the crash. You had them each in the living room, one living room playing bridge, another living room, kids, a couple guys sitting around talking. You had the police in their cruisers, where they were and what they were doing just moments before, and then, of course, the reaction. And at first, I wasn't sure about the characters that you were introducing at that very moment, because some of them, of course, aren't lead, you know, main characters in the story, but then when you brought them all to that scene of the crash, then it all made sense.
Well, I tried to approach this the way I consider myself a reporter, not a mm-hmm. writer. And I decided to approach this, how would I write about this crash if it were taking place today? And so it led to, I interviewed about 125 people over a four-year span, but I found as many people as I could who were at that site. And, you know, what they were doing. One guy's thinking about, you know, checking out Playboy magazine. Another guy is on the phone talking to his buddy. Another guy is, you know, watching a movie he can't stand. And all these people, these are first-generation wealthy. They're not super wealthy. They're upper middle class.
Right.
But they had all started out from fairly modest backgrounds, and the fathers worked extremely hard and became very successful. Of course, this is an era where the mothers were stay-at-home mothers. It was the father was the one with the career. But what I wanted to do was to take everybody back there and feel that impact. And it was very challenging because the two survivors, Bruce Berridge and Mike Adair, have no memory of that day at all. I mean, they vaguely remember being at the pizza parlor throwing pizza crust around at each other, kind of screwing off. But they don't remember being in the car. And fortunately, I was able to find a witness who was in a car behind them, and he was able to describe exactly how it happened.
They did no memory of it, and that was problem for them because by the time it took him, was it Bruce? It took him a while to even realize where he was.
Yes.
Many days.
Bruce was out for about 8 days. He was in sort of a semi-state of, I don't know what the legal phrase would be, sort of a semi-coma, because he has no memory of it, and yet he was screaming out loud in the hospital, and hysterically people would walk in. I remember at one point a priest walked in and he swore at him. And his mother, Rita Berridge, who's sort of like a June Cleaver figure, you know, she's like going around to people. Well, my God, where did he learn these words? That's not Bruce. Well, heck, he was a junior in high school. They learn how to swear at that age. but Bruce remembers slowly waking up after 8 days. And he sees a nurse over him, and he starts reading her name. And the first thing he says is, "Where's Roddy?" Roddy was his close friend, and he knew something was wrong. So it took him a long time, and he was in rehabilitation for months. He had to learn how to walk again. He had to learn how to do everything all over again. And today, Bruce is a very successful vet in Duxbury, Massachusetts, which is just south of Boston.
He survived, but he was one of the, it seems like, criteria for him was not to do it at home. He left, and he really never went back.
He never went back. Bruce is probably the most sensitive and the quietest of the people I talk to. He would go to Roddy's grave a lot, and he would just stand there. And one time there's this scene in the book where all their friends are together, and all of a sudden Bruce disappears, and they're trying to figure out, well, where's Bruce? And someone says, I think I know where he is. They went to the cemetery, and he was standing in front of Rod's grave, and he goes, I just came to see Roddy. And finally, I think Bruce just decided at some point after he'd gone to Michigan State, I can't do this the rest of my life. I just can't do this anymore.
And he left.
Mike, on the other hand, Mike is a miracle of modern science. Dr. Denton Cooley, the famed heart surgeon in Houston, did a very groundbreaking, pioneering operation with him, putting a piece of Dacron in his aorta to keep him alive. Mike today not only talks about the accident, he's He calls Alex Grether, who was the kid across the street who held him still in the car that night. He calls the doctor who helped save him his life. He wants to talk about this. They handled it in very different ways.
We are talking about Henderson's Light, Drinking, Driving, and a Deadly Encounter. It's Jack Torrey's latest book. We are also going to be joined by the Center for Auto Safety Executive Director Clarence Ditlow. Dr. Ditlow?
Yes, hello.
Hi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You know, it's kind of interesting when I'm reading this book, and I don't know if you've seen it or not, but so much of it is really, what have we learned? It's kind of, it's more than ironic that the kids that day, the day that they came back, they were going to go back to school, we're going to hear a speech or a talk on youth driving and teen driving and the dangers of driving. It's still going on, isn't it?
It certainly is, and we have, now a new danger beyond alcohol, which is texting and talking while driving.
Has anything changed regarding alcohol in teens, or are the statistics about where they were, have they steadied, or...?
They're pretty much where they were. The biggest single change in teen driving is the adoption by many states of so-called graduated driver's licenses, which requires a teenager not to drive during certain hours, to have a certain amount of training. But the major thing is that it really gets the teens out of the car when they're younger.
It gets them out of the car, and it also, there's some states, many states have limited how many other teens can be in the car with them.
That's true. All these factors are that teens are most readily distracted. They are not aware of the dangers of driving, and you need measures that get them acclimated and get them to an older age at which they can drive safely.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. Today I'm talking with Jack Torrey. He's the Columbus Dispatch Washington Bureau reporter. His new book, Henderson's Light, Drinking, Driving, and a Deadly Encounter, recalls the horrific accident 45 years ago in Birmingham, Michigan, that killed four kids and seriously wounded two others. Also, Center for Auto Safety Executive Director Clarence Ditlow. One thing that you can change a lot of the factors, but ultimately you can't change teens. If you have a story, a comment, a question, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, Jack, doesn't it feel sometimes like Mike Drothler could have just as easily been texting?
He could have been. And it's one of my great advantages in life is I am a Luddite, and I cannot text. So there's never a danger of me trying to text while I'm driving because I can't text while I'm sitting at my desk. But, yes, the technological changes today, people yakking on their cell phones it would be like typing a story as I'm driving a car. I can't even imagine doing such a thing. The one thing I did want to say, though, was your other guest is absolutely correct. The statistics show, bear out, that teens are not the safest drivers, and they just aren't. But one of the reasons I wanted to pick this accident was because it was the 22-year-old who had been drinking. I thought if I wrote a book about a bunch of teens behaving foolishly, kids wouldn't pay any attention to it. In this case, it was able to show them, yes, an adult acted badly and caused this misery, but just as easily it could have been the other way around.
Is there any way that typical the distracted teen syndrome might have played a role in this? In other words, if there had been an adult driver, a more experienced driver behind the wheel than Roddy Henderson, is it possible or was it inevitable that there was going to be this horrible crash?
In this case, Rod was the type of driver, and his sister writes about this in her diary. He tended to look, fidget with the radio and talk to everybody in the car. There's five kids in the car. Having said that, the way the turn is in the road, an experienced driver could not have escaped this guy. The other guy was coming from around a bend at 75 miles an hour. There were no screeching of brakes. Nobody had any time to react.
Okay.
And so in this case, yes, you have a young driver who probably was not the best at paying attention, but in this case, it wouldn't have mattered anyway.
When many of the distracted driving crashes involving cell phones, you just have someone who's totally oblivious to the conditions. And one of the classic cases is David Tater lost his son, Joe, who was the fourth car going through a full green light, and a car from the other direction went not only through a red light, but through a light that had been red for 30 seconds.
Yeah, there was no chance, right?
No chance at all.
I was sort of surprised, Jack, and Dr. Dillo, tell me, you know, the history a little bit, if you can, about that there was going to be a session on the dangers of teen driving that day back in 1965. Was it starting to be a problem then, or, you know, when did we all figure out that maybe teens and cars aren't necessarily or can be a lethal mix?
Well, I think ever since the Traffic Safety Agency was created, we knew that younger drivers were at risk. Insurance companies knew that. They charged additional premiums if you had a teenage driver in your family. So I can't really think of a time, at least within my life, when we didn't know that teenage drivers were less safe.
I think if you look at the film American Graffiti, which takes place in California in the early 60s, you see the same thing. Ironically, I remember this vividly at Seaholm when I was a sophomore. Al Unser, the race car driver, came to give a speech to the students, and the first thing he said was, "Well, I'm here just to watch the 3:30 drag race out of the school parking lot." And he was not exaggerating. Kids got in their car and zoomed out of there. So it's unfortunately it's nothing new. And I wish I could say I was a perfect teen driver, but I made my zooms too.
Yeah, I can recall in high school when the state trooper would come out to the junior class and talk to everyone about, well, you're about to get your driver's license, and that's good news for you, but it's bad news for your family and other people on the road because you are not a safe driver.
I guess I was kind of a dork. You know, I got it when I was in the 70s, and they showed that movie, and I'm sure there's a movie like it everywhere where they show a horrible crash and the shattering glass and told you how it's a however many tons a car is, you know, a killing machine, and it's a murder weapon and blah, 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 and I fell for it completely and totally. And it took me years before I wasn't terrified to drive on the expressway and particularly pass somebody. In fact, I still don't like passing people on a two-lane road, so... this is All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about Henderson's Light, Drinking, Driving, and a Deadly Encounter, Jack Torrey's latest book, and also joining us, Center for Auto Safety Executive Director Clarence Ditlow. We're talking about teen driving. Some things never change, and that is the teen behind the wheel. Got some memories, questions, comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is Capital City Radio.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
And this is Capital City Radio.
The Eiffel Tower built a smaller scale. The freshest oxygen I'd ever inhale.
Capital City Radio is the center of music and news. The new service from WOSU. Online at capitalcityradio.org.
Good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides will be here. As the healthcare debate continues, we'll hear from the patient's point of view about coping without health insurance or inadequate health insurance. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Currently 55 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40. We're on our way to a beautiful Monday. Sunshine today and a high of 70 degrees. Cloudy skies tonight and a low of 45. For Tuesday, mostly cloudy skies, a chance of afternoon rain showers and a high of 63 degrees. The low Tuesday night, right around 39. Looking ahead to Wednesday, partly cloudy skies and a high of 56. And then a little chilly again Wednesday night, a low of 31. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about teen driving, inspired by the book by Jack Torrey, Columbus Dispatch Washington Bureau reporter. The name of a book, his book, Henderson's Light, Drinking, Driving, and a Deadly Encounter. And also joining us, Center for Auto Safety Executive Director Clarence Ditlow. Yeah, I was looking at the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, actually has a teen driver's fact sheet. It is like a disease. And it says that motor vehicle crashes are the leading cause of death for U.S. teens, accounting for more than one in three deaths in this age group. In 2007, 11 teens ages 16 to 19 died every day from motor vehicle injuries. And that wasn't necessarily alcohol related, was it, Dr. Ditlow?
No, it was... all forms of fatalities. Teenagers have historically been traffic deaths are the highest cause of death for 16 to 19 year olds. It's been that way for years.
I was reading a blog. It's by Tim Hollister. It's the name of the blog is called From Reed's Dad, and Tim Hollister, he's a lawyer, and he was his son died in a one car accident. I think 4 years ago, and now he has started this blog to educate people about the dangers of teen driving. Very recently, he wrote a letter to Senator Christopher Dodd in the U.S. Senate, asking him to reintroduce the U.S. Senate in the U.S. Senate the Stand Up Act, which would require states, which require the feds to use financial incentives and sanctions to prod states to adopt minimum national standards for their safe teen driving laws. What do you think of that legislation?
We fully support that legislation. I testified on it last week, and we're a member of a big coalition pushing it. It would effectively require all states to have graduated driver's licenses for teenagers, plus a number of other measures, because it is an epidemic, and we need to do something about it.
Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We do have an email now from Bob. Back then, I was in high school in Steubenville. I guess this is back in 1965. He says, I did a lot of stuff merely mirroring my peers. It seems to me that the context might be at least partially to blame. Play football, get drunk, shoot pool, no reason to be constructive. So I guess that's just sort of teen life in the United States. Right, Jack?
Well, there's another factor, too. When you're 16, you don't think anything can happen to you. I mean, you're indestructible. In the book, I talk about how these same kids had gone up to the Upper Peninsula in Michigan when they were like 15. They're zooming up the freeway at about 100 miles an hour. You're indestructible at that age. You don't think anything can possibly go wrong. So I think that plays into the fact that you're probably willing to take more risks because you don't think anything bad can happen to you.
We advocate one thing that we sometimes get criticized for being a nanny, but if you look at this speedometer, it goes up to 120 or even beyond on some vehicles. Mm-hmm. And teenagers want to see if they can get up to 120. We'd like to have it just top out at 85 or miles an hour because then you don't have the incentive to go beyond it.
Girls are catching up with boys too, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Girls used to be safer, but much safer than boys. But now the girls aren't a whole lot of different.
Okay. Mary, you're on the air. You want to talk about a teen driver who killed her sister in a drunken driving accident.
Yes. I'm just concerned because it was a very sad situation. And my sister was killed by a teen driver. And the consequences were just so minute because she was a juvenile. They kind of gave, I don't know what, compensation to the other kids that were in the car with her for telling them where to locate her, and therefore they couldn't use the fact that she had been drinking. And, in fact, in some of their statements that we were able to read afterwards, it said that she even laughed at the fact, which was probably nervousness, but laughed at the fact that she had hit somebody.
Mary, when was this? How long ago? And I'm sorry for your loss.
This was a couple years ago. Okay. And they basically took in my sister. She had some culpability, too, because she had been drinking and she had been at a concert and she was walking across the street. Not in a crosswalk, but it was where everybody walks across to, you know, to go to these concerts. And they specifically walked because they knew they were going to be drinking at the concert and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But so, yes, there is some responsibility there. But this young girl got off with like 30 days probation. And I'm like, what lesson? To me, it just said, okay, it's okay to hit somebody if you're 16 in Dublin and there's no consequences.
Yeah, how do we, Dr. Ditlow, how do we punish children when things, because they are children?
It's a difficult situation, and the courts and judges struggle with that all the time. Do we put someone in jail for 2 years? Do we treat them as an adult? In general, teenagers do, in fact, get off with more lenient sentences, but there's not really a good rehabilitation program that we can sentence them to or get them into. One of the best things that we like is to have them go around for several years giving lectures to other students on what happened to them in the crash and what the cost to the other family was.
Yeah, it seems to have a lot more impact on kids when other kids are talking to them about what they've done and what's happened.
That's my experience.
They don't want an old crank like me shaking my fist at them through the car window.
Or some professional safety advocate like myself.
Brandon, you're on the air. You want to talk about educating teens.
Yeah, I just think, you know, like you mentioned earlier, kids want to test out car speed. I think maybe a good way to sort of meet that is to have them go on track days. We've got, you know, tracks in Central Ohio. I think, you know, just the best way for them to find out what it's like to drive fast is to do it in the safest environment possible. And I think if we were, you know, to make that a little more accessible, a little more, you know, I guess, you know, ready, we probably cut down on that a lot, because once you go fast a couple times, it kind of, you know, wears itself out. I don't know. And other than that, I think we do better just to tell them the truth about why it's important not to speed, how hard it is, you know, just explain the physics to them. I didn't get a lot of explanation myself when I went through driving school.
You mean about how big the car is and how much it weighs? And
yeah, just, you know, just what it really means to try mm-hmm. to stop a car that weighs, you know, however many thousand pounds, you know, and to actually put that into, you know, material form by taking them on the track and trying to show them, like, hey, if you try to slow down for this corner too late, you're going off the track and you might hit a wall. And that's a little better than hitting somebody else. You know, you got a helmet on, you got, you know, your seat, you know, a different seat, you know, different belts, all that type of thing. So it's a different situation than just driving down the street with somebody with a second wheel in the car. It's totally different.
You know, nowadays, I mean, we've been working on this for many, many years, at least since 1965, when they talked about this, or they were going to have dangers of teen driving lecture at the school that the kids were going to back in Birmingham on the Monday that they were going to be returning to school. I wonder if the message alone is enough. Today, we do have a lot of – well, and I also wondered about whether how kids – you know, they're doing the computer games all the time, and they see a lot of violence and a lot of destruction and things getting blown up. And I wonder if it doesn't make any difference because of that. Dr. Ditlow?
Yeah, I'm not a psychologist, so I couldn't tell you. But one – you know, avenue of hope that we have in this area is to use technology, because we now can require alcohol interlocks in the cars if someone has been convicted of drunk driving, so that they can't start the car if they have been drinking.
Like a breathalyzer?
Like a breathalyzer.
Okay.
Also, we have the ability on cell phones through the GPS system that's in them that if someone is driving, that the cell phone will shut itself off, so you can't do a text message or get a text message or even talk.
The thing about, as a doctor just said, these types of crashes, whether texting, talking on the phone, drinking and driving, mm-hmm. they are totally preventable. They're very easy to prevent because, you know, if you have the ignition lock for first-time offenders, which in Ohio is not the case, there's technology that, you know, is 5-10 years from now where if you've been drinking too much and you get in the car and touch the wheel just won't let you go because
you've been drinking, you're over the limit. Now, that's 10 years down the road, but these things are preventable. I mean, people don't have to text message while they're driving their car. And they certainly don't have to have, you know, four scotch and waters and get in a car and drive 20 miles home. So we are capable of overcoming this if we want. The problem is just the statistics show we're not.
Okay, let's take a call. Rosie, you have some bad memories.
Well, it's bad and good. And if your journalist knows the name of the town I'm talking about, I'd sort of appreciate if he not mention it.
Okay.
Many, many decades ago, but after his book, there was a horrific accident in Western Ohio, and many students, many of my classmates were killed, and they were not driving. They were standing along a roadside, and a non-teen, an older drunk driver came and killed many of them. And it was a very small town. It was a village that I grew up in, and fewer than 3,000 people, so a very tight-knit community.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the first responders were related to the kids who died and all. And he was talking about everybody went back to work or went to school the next day in the Michigan town he was talking
mm-hmm.
about. Well, this happened on a Saturday night in my situation. And we all went back to work on Monday and back to school and all. And but we had sort of had no choice. The kids who were the immediate families, of course, stayed home. But the rest of us, a lot of people were related. A lot of the teachers were related. But it was sort of the message that we all had over and over was, you've got to go back to work. These were a lot of farm families.
But was there any counseling or anything like that, any acknowledgement?
Oh, there was acknowledgement everywhere, and there still is to this day. But the thing that was, it was everywhere, and we got off school for the funeral. I know that all the volunteer firefighters got off work wherever they were. We had no paid for us at the time because the pews in the church had to be, the side pews had to be taken up because there were too many kids to go into any of the funeral homes. And so they just had one mass wake and they put all the kids in the church. And so they took up the side pews for the caskets. And so the firefighters had to take those pews up. And it was just constant. So I guess we tried to have class. I don't remember. I remember everybody was kind of numb.
How old were you, Rosie, at the time?
At the time, I was a junior.
Okay.
And so I was driving. And I don't think it affected my driving that much because I had started as a sophomore.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just the thing that was the best thing that happened was that the priest called all the parents in before the funeral. And none of the parents told me about this, but from the talk that I've heard since then, is that the priest called the parents in and said, I'm not going to have the funeral unless you talk to the man who did this. Because if you keep on hating him and don't start forgiving him, you're going to lose your children a second time. You're going to focus on hating him and not focus on remembering your children.
Mm-hmm.
And you're never going to heal yourself. And you know, the religious theme, too, that you're not doing God's work. And so he had all the parents get together. And then the man who did this, of course, if you drive into a crowd of people, and enough to kill many of them, you're going to do some damage to yourself. So he was in the hospital. They brought him out of the hospital and met at the priest there and met with the parents. And just enough to say, okay, we're starting to forgive you.
Jack, thanks, Rosie. Thank you very much for your call.
Mm-hmm.
Jack, that was one aspect of your story I thought was interesting, is Mike Drothler's parents visited the parents of the kids who were killed in the accident.
You know, and I don't think they do that today because of the possibility of lawsuits
right.
and things like that. But Jackie Barnum, who was the older sister of Barbara Barnum, remembers a knock at the door, and she opens it up, and there are the Drothlers, and they apologized. It was very, very touching. And one of Fred Drothler's friends told me about a year, when I first told him about this, about a year ago, he started crying on the phone. He said, that's Fred. He was a salt-of-the-earth guy. I mean, in many ways, this was a tragedy involving all sides because the Drothlers lost their son, too, and it wasn't their fault. But the fact is it doesn't change the fact that that accident, like almost every one of these, is preventable. And it's up to, you know, it's up to public officials and school officials to make it as preventable as possible.
The scar, of course, is that these kids were so young, and you know, all you can do is think about, you know, what coulda, woulda, shoulda. And yet these sorts of preventable accidents are what is the leading cause of death for U.S. teens. It's kind of amazing. Let's take a call from Matt. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to mention a product that I heard in another NPR program. I think it may have been All Things Considered, although I'm not really sure.
Okay.
It's called Key to Safe Driving, and it's a device that, I mean, one of your guests just mentioned that, you know, there's technology that kind of can tell based on GPS or triangulation whether or not your cell phone is moving, and then makes the assumption that you're driving and can disable your phone.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it turns out that that's not that great, because you could be the passenger in a car, in which case it would be fine to use your phone, or on the bus or a taxi or a bike or whatever. Mm-hmm. But they have a device that will plug into sort of the little diagnostic computer port under your steering wheel and, you know, sync up with the phone of a driver, and then make that phone inoperable when that person is in that car. And it will, if someone gets a text message, it will reply with a text message saying that they're driving, and they'll respond when they get to their
okay.
destination. It will route all phone calls to voicemail. But it will allow 911 calls, or you can make exceptions, like where you can call your parents. And so that it's kind of nice, so that you still get the emergency functionality, and you can sort of tell whether you're the driver or you're just a passenger.
Okay.
And it will, I think since they're kind of marketing for teens, even though I'm ashamed to admit that I text message while driving and plan on buying one of these for myself.
Shame, Matt. You know,
yeah.
Matt, I hate to cut you off. We're running out of time, though.
I just have one more
important real quick
thing. It has a thing that if someone takes it out, it can send a text message or voicemail to the parents, letting
okay.
them know that it's been bypassed.
Okay, now that means parents have to learn to text. We've been talking about teen driving, thank you very much, with Jack Torrey, the author of Henderson's Light, Drinking Driving and a Deadly Encounter, and also Center for Auto Safety Executive Director Clarence Ditlow. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being on the show. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.